Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for July 8th, 2014. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'll be talking with Ted Young about how the kinase SNF1 regulates mRNA decay in yeast. SNF1 is a serine threonine kinase that gets activated when yeast cells are deprived of glucose. Glucose is the preferred energy source of yeast, but when they're deprived of glucose, the cells can change their metabolism to use other carbon sources to get the energy that they need to survive. Activation of SNF1 by glucose deprivation triggers changes in gene expression that allow the cells to metabolize other carbon sources. In addition to promoting gene transcription, SNF1 has also been implicated in preventing the decay of transcripts that encode the proteins that help the cell survive without glucose. In an effort to understand more about how SNF1 may stabilize transcripts, a group led by Ted Young used proteomic analysis to identify proteins that are downstream of SNF1 and involved in messenger RNA metabolism. Young is a professor in the Department of Biochemistry at the University of Washington, and he joins me now by telephone. Hello, Dr. Young. Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast.
Glad to be with you.
When you started this current project, what was known about how SNF1 affected mRNA stability?
There wasn't very much known. There were no proteins that SNF1 was involved with that implicated SNF1 in functioning at the level of RNA degradation or RNA translation or anything other than transcription was pretty much terra incognita at that time. So that's why we decided we needed to take some different approach to try to identify proteins that might be targets of SNF1 that would be involved in RNA processing. So that was the reason we decided that fossil proteomics would be a good approach to try to identify proteins that were carrying the message from SNF1 to the RNA to cause it to be either more stable or less stable under different conditions.
What was that phosphoproteomics-based experimental approach? How did you identify proteins that are involved in SNF1-mediated transcript stabilization?
So what we did was we decided to take a very global approach and try to identify all the proteins that were phosphorylated in a SNF1-dependent manner. So what I mean by that is the proteins that might be phosphorylated directly by SNF1, that is, they were actually substrates of SNF1, or they could be substrates of a different kinase, and that kinase was actually phosphorylated and activated by SNF1. So we decided we wanted to identify both types of what I might call targets of SNF1, because it might be that SNF1 acted indirectly in this manner, and if we just looked at substrates of SNF1, we might miss the important proteins. So we took a very global approach and took advantage of the fact that Rudy Ebersold's lab in Zurich, Switzerland, has pioneered the use of phosphoproteomics analysis in a quantitative and very precise manner to identify kinase substrates. He had a very talented graduate student named Stefania Vaga who was capable of carrying out this kind of analysis. Normally what you do in this case, you isolate all the proteins from a wild-type strain. Under those conditions, SNF1 would be active. And then to have some comparison, you also isolate all the proteins from a mutant strain of yeast that doesn't have SNF1. And then you do a comparison between the wild type and the mutant to see which phosphoproteins are missing in the mutant but are present in the wild type. To be absolutely sure we'd capture as many important proteins as possible, instead of using just one mutant, we actually use three different mutants and multiple replicates of each one of those three mutants. So we have a very deep and rich data set to analyze.
In comparing the phosphoproteomes of normal yeast strains and the SNF1 mutants, what sorts of proteins did you identify as having phosphorylation that was dependent on SNF1 activity?
So the big surprise was that one of the major classes of SNF1 targets was in the category of RNA processing. What had been known before would have sort of suggested that most of the protein SNF1 was phosphorylating would probably be involved in transcriptional regulation, because that was a major class that had been identified by genetic approaches. And that differs somewhat from the situation of the SNF1 ortholog in animal cells and in plant cells. And this kinase, which is the homolog of SNF1, is called the AMP-activated kinase because it's activated by adenosine monophosphate. And the substrates of the AMP kinases in animal cells were primarily in the category of metabolism.
in your screen, you identified proteins that play a role in RNA decay or RNA stabilization as having a phosphorylation status that's dependent on SNF1.
Right.
Which of those proteins did you follow up on, and did you figure out how any of those proteins' activities are regulated by SNF1?
So that's the crux of the matter. So we identified, as I say, about 20 proteins that were phosphorylated in a SNF1-dependent manner. So then you say, okay, now how am I going to find out which ones of those are actually being regulated by SNF1? So first of all, what you want to know is, if you mutate those genes that are involved in RNA processing, do you affect RNA decay or RNA synthesis just generally, without at first asking whether or not that influence is acting through SNF1? And so the genes we focused on were about 15 genes that were all annotated, that is, they were functionally shown by previous work to be involved in messenger RNA processing in some way. So what we did was we examined all of those for a number of properties: how well they grew, how well they survived on trying to grow them on different carbon sources. And then finally, we asked whether or not they were involved in messenger RNA decay. And in order to see whether they're involved in messenger RNA decay, you can't just look at the total RNA level, because then you're looking at both the rate of synthesis and the rate of decay. So what you have to do is somehow shut off RNA synthesis, and then you look at the level of that messenger RNA, the abundance of that messenger RNA, as a function of time after turning off transcription. So we turn off transcription, and then we measure the level of a particular group or several messenger RNAs as a function of time. And using that assay, we found that three or four out of these 15 proteins that we'd identified as SNF1 targets all slowed down the rate of messenger RNA decay. And of course, we were only looking at a small group of messenger RNA, so it could be that the others were influencing the stability of messenger RNAs that we didn't assay. But anyway, that led us to these three or four different genes, and we decided to focus on one of those genes, a gene called XRN1, which has been previously shown to be a ribonuclease, which is involved in RNA decay in various pathways.
And so then how does SNF1 regulate XRN1 activity, and then how does that then affect the stability of RNAs?
So we had first identified XRN1 by the phosphoproteomics analysis as being phosphorylated in a SNF1-dependent manner. So what we did was mutate the sites in this protein, XRN1, that were phosphorylated in a SNF1-dependent manner, and ask whether the mutation in those sites influence the rate of messenger RNA decay. When we mutated the sites in XRN1, then we saw a change in the rate of decay of the messenger RNA, almost as though we had deleted the whole XRN1 gene. So what that suggests is that SNF1, when it phosphorylates XRN1, allows it to maintain its normal level of activity. So that was sort of a surprise, because what we expected was that if we mutated those sites, then it would mimic more the behavior of a SNF1 mutant, but it looks instead like SNF1 is allowing XRN1 to carry out its normal function.
How does XRN1 promote mRNA decay?
So XRN1 has been known for a long time as being involved in messenger RNA decay in the cytoplasm. When people looked at the location of XRN1 by immunofluorescence, they found that the majority of it, at least, was certainly in the cytoplasm. But then what we found and what these other workers showed was that that's apparently not the only function of XRN1, because what we found was that in an XRN1 mutant, RNA decay is definitely affected very strongly, and the RNA is much more stable. But surprisingly, the amount of messenger RNA that we could detect was also greatly affected by XRN1's absence. And specifically, what we found was that if you mutated XRN1, the total abundance of messenger RNA was dramatically reduced. And that was exactly the opposite of what we had expected from the XRN1 mutant, because the amount of RNA that's present should be affected in a positive way by slowing down decay. So the amount of messenger RNA is going to be positively influenced by how much is synthesized and negatively influenced by how much is degraded. So if you don't degrade the RNA as much, then you'd expect there to be more RNA. But what we found was, in fact, there was a lot less. So that was just sort of a conundrum. How can you explain the reduced amount of messenger RNA when, in fact, its stability is higher? So that suggested that exocrine to us at that time, sort of in our naivety, that exocrine 1 was involved in both transcription of the messenger RNA and the decay of the same messenger RNA. And about that time, a couple of other papers came out, one from a lab in Israel and another one from a lab in Germany, that suggested that exocrine 1 is involved in what they called messenger RNA balancing, trying to keep the amount of messenger RNA constant by buffering the levels by influencing in one way RNA synthesis and in another way RNA decay. So that if, for example, nucleotides became less abundant to the cell, so that RNA synthesis rates went down, then in order to keep the messenger RNA constant, exon 1 somehow reduced the rate of decay of the messenger RNA so that the total amount of messenger RNA would remain pretty much unchanged. So these two groups agreed that exon 1 was involved in this buffering somehow, and they both agreed that exon 1 was necessary for normal rates of decay, but they came up with different ideas about how that was achieved. So the jury's still out, I think, on exactly what the mechanism is, but it's pretty clear that exon 1 is involved in this buffering of messenger RNA levels, so that if something happens so that rates of synthesis are slowed down, then rates of decay are also slowed down, so that the influence on the messenger RNA amount is relatively invariant. The question then is, to us, was, well, is SNF1 really involved in this buffering? If you want to buffer messenger RNA levels, that's fine when the cells are growing at steady state and conditions aren't changing and the RNA populations aren't changing. But imagine what would happen if suddenly conditions change so that you wanted to replace one messenger RNA population with another. Then a buffering would be counterproductive because in that case you want to change the total level of RNAs that were no longer needed and replace them with new kinds of RNAs that were going to allow the cell to adapt to new conditions. So under those conditions, you might expect that the activity of exon 1 would have to be modified or regulated in some way. So that's what we postulate SNF1 does, that when cells change nutrient conditions, go from growing in rich medium to growing in poor medium, for example, then you need to somehow change the activity of exon 1 so it adopts a new stance in this buffering regimen so that a new balance can be achieved with new RNAs appearing without increasing their rate of degradation because their rates of synthesis had increased. Our model, anyway, is that SNF1 controls the activity of exon 1 so that the buffering of the messenger RNA pools can be altered to achieve a new kind of steady state.
SNF1-mediated regulation of XRN1 basically allows cells to be able to rapidly change gears to adapt to a different carbon source.
Yeah, good succinct paraphrase.
How is XRN1 activity specifically directed to those transcripts that encode the proteins that are required for this change in metabolism? How do you keep it from globally affecting housekeeping genes?
Yeah, that's the big mystery. One idea is certainly that the phosphorylation in XRN1 is involved in that somehow, but we don't really have any evidence yet that that's the case. It could be that there's actually some other auxiliary proteins that are involved in conferring the specificity and not XRN1 itself. So the other possible idea suggested by some other recent work, primarily from Trotter's group in Israel, is that something is happening during the process of transcription that endows the messenger RNAs with a specific mark of some kind on the messenger RNAs. It's conceivable that messenger RNAs of one type have a slightly different kind of cap. Maybe it's modified in a slightly different way. And once that messenger RNA leaves the cytoplasm, maybe that modified cap on the messenger RNA provides the specificity that you need to say this messenger should be degraded under some conditions but not under other conditions.
So maybe those transcripts that are induced by SNF1 would have some sort of mark that distinguishes them from other transcripts that would allow XRN1 to specifically target those.
Exactly.
Yeast SNF1 is homologous, as you mentioned, to the AMPKs of animals. Is there any indication that AMPKs also affect mRNA stability in a manner that might be similar to the way SNF1 does in yeast?
No, I think that's the next important question. Whether if you did similar kinds of studies in mammals, you would also identify messenger RNAs whose stability was dependent on AMPK. That'd be a very nice kind of study to perform, and It's a little more difficult to do in animal cells because there are two different AMPK isozymes, two different catalytic subunits. So you have to engineer the cells so that either both of them can be deleted or both of them can be inhibited. We were fortunate in that yeast only has a single AMPK ortholog, SNF1. And also, because a lot of people have been interested in this kinase, they had made what are called analog-sensitive alleles of the protein kinase. And using a procedure that was pioneered by Kevin Shokat at UCSF, we were able to get one of these analog-sensitive alleles of SNF1 and some of the inhibitors from Shokat's lab, so that you can inhibit SNF1 after transcription has started. And that is what allowed us to identify this RNA stability that was dependent on SNF1.
And so that would be more difficult to do in the case of AMPK in animal cells.
No, more difficult, but certainly not impossible.
Thanks, Dr. Young. Thanks for speaking with me.
It's been a pleasure. It's always fun to try to explain some complex process to another person because it sort of clarifies it in your own mind.
That was Ted Young discussing a paper published in the July 8th issue of Science Signaling by Braun and colleagues. You can read that article online at stke.sciencemag.org. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, serving society. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and AAAS, thanks for listening.